From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Do you have a favorite Adult Swim show?
I turned myself into a pickle, Morty! Boom! Big reveal, I'm a pickle. What do you think about that? I turned myself into a pickle!
There's all kinds of rocks. These is rocks which you throw. These here is rocks that you get...
Damn, Daddy.
I am the bat.
Yes, yes, you're the bat. And the bat is the reason we didn't take Best Groot Costume, mister. Again! Last year, it was Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion, and the Bat.
Those are clips from Rick and Morty, Squidbillies, and the Venture Brothers. Later this hour, we tour the Adult Swim studios right here in Atlanta. But first, we talked last week about Confederate monuments across Georgia. Serge LeCompte of Smyrna, Georgia, told us he sees a role for Confederate monuments.
It's definitely a value. It's sort of like with the situation, you know, in Germany. You can't totally erase history, and people are already forgetting that the Holocaust existed. People believe that it didn't exist. So you need the statues and memorials around to, you know, since it is a part of history, and prove and show to people that it actually did happen, you know.
And Courtney Ray in Athens has a few thoughts as well.
In Germany, there are Holocaust museums dedicated to the victims of the Holocaust, not to the perpetrators, to the Nazis who actually committed these war crimes. But instead, here we want to memorialize those people who were the perpetrators of genocide and white supremacy, instead of memorializing the slaves and those other people who were victims of these crimes.
We always love to get your ideas, so give us a call and leave a message. 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter. We are at OST Talk. Just remember that we might feature your comments on the show. A record number of guns were confiscated in 2017 at Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. According to the Transportation Security Administration, 245 guns were caught, all but 23 were loaded. That increase follows a national trend, but for yet another year, the Atlanta airport leads the nation in the number of guns found, and maybe not for the reasons you'd think. I talked about this issue last year with Kelly Yamanucci, a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who focuses on airport-related stories, and also Tom Barton, a Georgia criminal defense lawyer.
Good morning.
Why does the TSA describe this, Kelly, as guns that are caught, not confiscated?
Well, the reason is because TSA itself doesn't confiscate the guns, and they don't. They say that they don't confiscate items generally. Instead, once a gun is caught at a security checkpoint, the lane gets shut down, and then the Atlanta Police Department at the airport precinct is called over to the checkpoint, and then the person and the gun is taken over to the precinct.
So I want to play this comment from Douglas Kidd. He's with the National Association of Airline Passengers. He's speaking to CBS here and saying the TSA needs to get better at screening for weapons.
What I think their biggest failure is not looking at the whole picture of airport security, because if anything's going to be a real danger to us, it's not going to come through the checkpoint, it's going to come around the checkpoint.
Do we have, Kelly, a pretty good understanding of any allowed item that comes through, whether it's a checkpoint or in checked luggage or anything like that?
There is screening of checked luggage as well, and guns are allowed through checked luggage if they are declared and properly packed. And so the airlines are responsible for making sure that is done properly, as well as the passengers. But there is screening of checked baggage as well.
So, Tom, how are we to understand this record number of guns caught at Atlanta? I mean, Atlanta's the biggest airport, the busiest airport in the world. But not all those people are going through checkpoints. We're only number 5 or 6 when it comes from number of passengers going through checkpoints.
Right. That's a very good question. The reason behind it is two things. Number one, Atlanta-Hartsfield is the busiest airport in the country, so you're going to have more volume. That's number one. Number two, Southern gun culture. Lots and lots of folks in the South have guns. My clients, by and large, that I've represented are great people. They're business owners, partners in firms downtown, very successful people who travel all the time. And they kept the gun in the car, but then they put it in their briefcase and they forgot about it. It was there for months. They got called to fly to Houston. They go through the checkpoint and it goes off. So it's really an oversight. There's no malintent. It's not a situation of something bad.
Let's hear this comment from Scott Johnson. He's the Federal Security Director at Dulles International Airport in D.C. He doesn't believe that most of the people who say it's an oversight. Here's his comment.
I'll ask a passenger direct to the face, do you have anything prohibitive in the bag? No. We open up the bag, they'll have a knife, they'll have a fake gun, they'll have a nunchuck in there. And I just have to laugh at him because it's, do you think you can bring this on?
So, I mean, I imagine, Tom, for people who don't regularly, aren't regularly around guns like myself, it's hard to imagine you threw a gun in your briefcase and forgot about it.
Happens every day. Very, very easy mistake to make. We all make those sorts of mistakes. You know, where's the remote to your television right now? Bet you can't tell me.
I know exactly where my remote is, Tom.
Well, a lot of people can't. And all of my clients that I've dealt with have been really great folks who made a mental error. They put the gun in a backpack a year earlier. They packed for a trip. They're going through TSA. All of a sudden, all the bells and whistles go off. Oh my gosh, there's a gun in your bag. And then if they have a carry permit, they get written a citation to federal court. If they don't, then they get arrested and taken to the Clayton County Jail.
Do you think that's unfair for them to be taken to jail?
That is a question that is for someone else. The federal
But
program,
you're defending them. I mean, do you personally think that's too harsh?
I think for the average client that I deal with, it is a simple oversight. There's no malintent. If there's any evidence of bad intentions, if there's something bad about the background of the client, or if there's something funny with the gun, then that deserves further attention. But the way the federal government handles it, I think, is appropriate. They send it to federal court. There's a small, what's called collateral forfeiture. You pay that. You pay a TSA fine for violating the rules, and you move on. There's no permanent record created.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with criminal defense lawyer Tom Barton and AJC reporter Kelly Yamanuchi. Kelly, do we have any idea whether the increase in the number of guns caught is because they're getting better at detecting these things, or whether it's because more people are forgetting or trying to bring weapons on a plane?
You know, it is possible that that they're getting better, because there have been reports about TSA missing prohibited items in the past. So it's possible they're getting better, but I think that more people carrying guns could be a factor, as well as the increase in passenger counts generally. So if you have, you know, an increase in passengers, which we've had every year for the past few years, then you have increased likelihood of people forgetting guns. And
can I ask you the same question about why it's Hartsfield-Jackson? Because as I mentioned, even though we're an incredibly busy airport, the busiest, mm-hmm. A lot of those people are never getting through the checkpoints, right? They're on connecting flights.
That's right. The majority of passengers in Atlanta at the airport are connecting, and so most of them don't go through security in Atlanta. But different states have different gun laws, and some states have much more restrictive gun laws, such as New York, and they may have a lower share of people who carry. So.
Tom, do you think that people are generally pretty well aware of the law, though? I mean, in terms of what you can or cannot, not just a gun. I think most people know you can't bring them a gun. But he mentioned all kinds of things that you're not allowed to bring on a plane. Do you think people are pretty well aware?
I think the average gun owner inherently knows that it would be illegal to try to get a firearm on an aircraft. However, the effort that they put in to prevent that from happening could be better. In speaking with TSA, they recommend that gun owners put a carabiner through the trigger lock of their guns, and then when they move the gun to a piece of luggage, take the carabiner and put it on the handle of the bag. That way you know there's a gun in that bag, and that's a great way to prevent this from happening.
So, Kelly, what does the TSA's response? We get these numbers out every year. So how does the TSA sort of put this in context in terms of what their response should be?
The TSA has really done a lot of publicity of all of the prohibited items that are caught at checkpoints all the time. I think with the goal of trying to discourage people from bringing these prohibited items, to raise awareness that these items are prohibited and to show that it's such a common occurrence. They have, over the past couple of years in particular, put an increased emphasis on training of TSA screeners and officers to catch prohibited items.
Let's hear. We actually went to the Silver Skillet restaurant next door. We asked people sitting there what they thought about having guns in airports. The first responder in this tape did not give his name.
I personally believe let the officials that are planted on the plane do their job. You don't really need a gun while you're flying.
My name is Ian Smith. I feel safer that they're being confiscated. That seems like somebody doing their job. If they're not supposed to be on airplanes, confiscating them seems like the right answer.
Rod Beard. If everybody carried a gun, I would feel a lot more safe, I think. I mean, that way, you know, you got a chance to fight back.
Of course, anyone listening, you can give us your opinions on this. You know how to reach us through social media or calling 404-500-9457. Kelly, does the TSA let us know how many of these guns that are caught are from people who overlooked them, as Tom was describing, and people who actually may be suspicious?
The TSA says the vast majority of people say that they just forgot that their gun was in their bag. And the other interesting point is that most of the guns are loaded when they're caught at security checkpoints.
Tom, what is the recourse? I mean, how long, if you forget your gun in your backpack and you get caught at security, right. And let's say you get taken to jail, what's the process then? What happens to you?
Right. Well, there are two processes. If you have a carry permit, you're simply issued a notice of violation for federal court a few months
later. Does it matter if it's open carry or regular carry?
No. If you have a carry permit, then the law in Georgia has been liberalized in the last few years to allow for guns at the airport, but not through the checkpoints. Now, the Georgia law that was passed under the Deal administration allowed for retreat. If you're notified that you have a gun, you have the opportunity to retreat, go back, and put the gun in your car. The feds came in and said, no, we're not playing that game. If you get past the lady that checks in, you know, the paperwork, mm-hmm. once you get that past that point, you're in a sterile point. It's too late. You can't go back. We're going to cite you and send you to federal court. So that's where we come in. We represent people in federal court, and we also represent people against the TSA in negotiating the very steep fines, which this year went from $3,000 up to almost $4,000.
At that point, to your experience, is it relatively easy to navigate? I mean, it's expensive, clearly,
right.
But otherwise relatively easy to navigate the system without getting a record?
That's a two-edged sword there. If everything goes just right and there are no problems, no background problems, no problems with the gun, then you can breeze right through. If there are any problems with the gun or if there's any evidence of bad intent on your part, or if you have a background problem, then you're going to need a lawyer.
Okay, we just spoke with Tom Barton. He's a Georgia criminal defense lawyer, and Kelly Yamanucci is reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Kelly and Tom, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Been my pleasure.
Just ahead, we'll take you with us on a tour of Atlanta's own Adult Swim. But first, are those new sports stadiums really worth the money? This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Over the past few years, Atlanta has seen any number of new sports stadiums arise. Mercedes-Benz Stadium and SunTrust Park cost more than $1 billion to build, and they each replaced stadiums that were only about two decades old. This month, a new Atlanta Hawks arena was scheduled to break ground in College Park, but many are calling on the city to halt construction until there's more proof it will be worth the cost. My colleague Adam Ragusa talked about the economic payoff and possible pitfalls of sports stadiums with Benjamin Flowers, professor of architecture at Georgia Tech, and also with Michael Alt, executive director of the Downtown Sacramento Partnership. That city has seen some economic boon since starting construction on their own basketball arena in 2014.
Professor Flowers, first of all, explain to us what is your interest in this topic area? This is something where we normally go to a sports economist as opposed to a professor of architecture, but you have a pretty intense interest in this area of discussion.
Yes. Well, I mean, my larger research area has always been monumental urban projects. And for most of the 20th century in most American cities, the biggest, most expensive, most technologically complex building in a city would be a skyscraper. But starting about 15 years ago, that really began to change. And in fact, now the tide has really turned. And in fact, what you find is in most cities, the biggest, most expensive, most complex engineering-wise and technology-wise project is going to be a stadium. Mercedes-Benz at, you know, around $1.6 billion is nearly three times as much as the next most expensive tall building in Atlanta at $440 million. So really, from an architectural perspective, these projects, because of their size, their cost and complexity, really are the places to look to see about how and what ways societies are valuing certain kinds of projects and certain kinds of modes of urban development and urban life.
And from an economic perspective, I think it's fair to say that there is a diversity of opinion among scholars about whether or not publicly funded stadiums actually pay off for their communities, at least in strictly economic senses. It depends greatly on how you define that, how indirectly you want to look for benefits. But going out to look at the situation in Sacramento, California, Michael Alt, you are the executive director of a downtown nonprofit that's seeking to benefit downtown Sacramento. And even skeptics of publicly funded stadiums have had some positive things to say about your experience. Tell me about what y'all built out there and what it's done for you.
Well, we knew from the beginning, the existing previous location of the existing arena was about 10 miles north of downtown. The discussion of siting the new facility within the core of the urban fabric here in Sacramento, we thought would really create some momentum from an investment, and it's absolutely happened. The facility itself, while it's, this is a one professional sports team town, the Sacramento Kings NBA team plays here, but it was always discussed as being about more than just basketball. I mean, the Kings play 40-something games a year, but the facility last year was active a little over 200 days, and so we saw foot traffic increase. We saw, more than 1.5 million users that weren't coming to downtown come in. It has spawned new retail projects, a couple of hotel projects that have been built around it. And so in our hopes originally of it being a catalyst for new capital investment, we're only 1.5 years into it, but so far it's pretty exciting, the kind of wave of momentum that has generated since it's opened.
Indeed, and in comparing it to our experience here in Atlanta, we talked to Arthur Blank, owner of the Atlanta Falcons, and he says that they decided to place Mercedes-Benz Stadium downtown so that they could boost nearby businesses there. Let's listen.
I think when you make a commitment to build a stadium that's right in the middle of the population, in this case, close to Centennial Park, close to the West Side, where the city and the center of the city becomes a place of attraction for guests to come and stay for a period of time. And whether it's the stadium or it's the other attractions or it's the hotels or the restaurants or the communities.
Professor Flowers at Georgia Tech, putting aside the very sticky question of economic cost-benefit analysis, is it true, at least according to your research, that publicly funded downtown stadium projects really do catalyze a lot of positive surrounding redevelopment that would not have otherwise taken place?
That's a fantastic question, and there's no easy answer because it varies so much by which kind of stadium you're talking about. So basketball arenas and the NBA operate very differently from the NFL, which operates differently from the MLS. And the paradox here is that in the NFL, there is revenue sharing across almost every sector of the league, except in terms of the revenues generated by the stadium. So the paradox is the average NFL stadium really doesn't want you spending time before and after the game outside of the stadium. They want you in the stadium, which is why you see at Mercedes-Benz a whole vast panoply of restaurants and bars and the idea of the spectator experience taking place in the stadium And so the idea of the stadium as a catalyst in that sense for regeneration in the surrounding neighborhoods is not as strong. Now, in other leagues, such as the NBA and MLS, which have a very different protocol for how and in which ways they manage their revenue streams, I think it can be, if that is the goal at the outset and planning is made to ensure that actually that can happen. Now, if you just say, if we build it, economic development will happen, then it generally does not. So there's no easy, straightforward answer across the board.
Yeah, Michael Ault in Sacramento, we're talking about an NBA team there, so that has no doubt affected the nature of the outcome from building the stadium in downtown Sacramento.
You know, it has, but, you know, one of the things, and I would agree, one of the things that is difficult to, you know, to identify is what would have come in the way of investment and projects without this facility. But I can tell you that there are, from an industry standpoint, you know, not only the brokerage community, but the investment community, retailers, are calling, communicating where these facilities are located, our level of interest in traffic and pedestrian counts and siting of new facilities around this arena and flow of traffic would not have happened, we feel, without this project. And, you know, we've got, since the construction began for us downtown, you know, we've seen almost $1 billion in new projects get developed and almost 38 different properties go through some form of renovation within a 6 to 8 block area of that facility, which is really transforming the urban core here for us.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Georgia Tech architecture professor Benjamin Flowers, also downtown Sacramento, California partnership executive director Michael Ault. We're talking about in public investments in downtown stadium projects and not just their economic benefits or lack thereof, depending on which experts you want to believe, but also the more intangible benefits. And let's actually pivot and talk a little bit about the intangibles. You have someone like Andrew Zimbalist, who's a very famous sports economist at Smith College, who is very, very skeptical based on his reading of the data about whether or not public investments in downtown stadiums really, really pay back on purely economic terms to those communities. But on the other hand, what I always wonder whenever I hear Zimbalist talk is, what about the intangibles? Isn't it true that to a certain extent, this isn't just about creating a facility that's going to generate a surplus of tax money back to the city? It's also just about intangibles like fun. People just like having a nice stadium in their city that attracts a high quality professional sports team. And is fun reason enough, Professor Flowers?
That's a really interesting question. In many ways, all architecture in some ways aspires to animate the intangibles in individuals. And certainly stadiums are a powerful tool for that. I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan of stadiums in spite of all my skepticism about the utility of public funding. And there's no doubt that when you go into a new stadium, whether it's empty or whether it's full, it is a powerful experience. And the sense of civic pride that a project can generate is undeniable. And so, yes, you could say that that is a proper aspiration for a stadium, but whether that's a proper use of public funds, I think, is somewhat more challenging to justify on an intangible basis, because intangibles are not widely shared across all communities. They're not shared uniformly. They are not shared necessarily over time. The affection people had for Mercedes-Benz initially has been somewhat muted by the fact that it's actually kind of hard to get out of the building when mm-hmm. the game is over. And in fact, I've talked to a number of people who are season ticket holders who are really frustrated by that. So the initial glow can fade. And so therefore, you know, given the scale of public investment, I think there has to be some caution about the value of fun as a justification for public dollars.
Of course, we could look beyond just the stadium. We could talk about other downtown reinvestment that happens arguably as a result of the construction of the stadium, as we've just heard, we've seen in Sacramento. Of course, Michael Ault, executive director of the Downtown Sacramento Partnership, Sacramento, among California cities, had a particular reputation as being a bit of a 9-to-5 city up until pretty recently, a place where people just kind of went to work and then they went home to their bedroom community. And you have seen that changing a little bit in recent years.
Absolutely. And, you know, your one of the previous questions you had asked was, you know, is this about fun? And I think, you know, a second part of that is it's about perception. And I think that there was a real reality when there was questions of whether or not to build this facility, whether the Kings would, Sacramento Kings would leave. What would that do to the region's reputation? What would it do to an urban center that historically had been looked at as simply a place people work? We're a capital city. We've got, you know, 100,000 employees Monday through Friday that work here. But, you know, it wasn't long ago that after 5:30, you know, downtown cleared out. And I think, you know, this facility, keeping the Sacramento Kings in Sacramento, building a very iconic state-of-the-art facility downtown, has created a real sense of regional pride in how Sacramento is perceived. Yes, it's added a lot more concerts. It's brought a lot of people here, but I think it's given the city some identity in how people look at Sacramento. And, you know, not just with the bars and entertainment and restaurants and cultural amenities that have followed the development of this facility, but I think it has changed the way people look at Sacramento's urban core much more holistically as a place where there are a lot of options, not just simply a place people work. And I think that that really has generated a real buzz for us in the capital markets that, you know, very candidly say, you know, Sacramento for years was on our radar. We looked at it, but now are coming here, sending representatives. We do walking tours, broker visits that just did not take place 3+ years ago. And I think you have to credit this facility with giving Sacramento a sense of identity.
But even if we take the whole stadium aspect out of this, if we just talk about public investments or even any kind of public sector action to revitalize downtowns, there is often an assumption that revitalizing a downtown is something that is going to be good for the community as a whole. But is that something that we should take for granted, Professor Flowers at Georgia Tech?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that most urban redevelopment projects in the United States today are anchored by sports architecture of some kind. And that is in part a reflection of a couple of political realities, one of which is the pullback of the federal government in urban regeneration projects, you know, dramatically since the 1960s. And the reality that public funds for investments in infrastructure, which could have an equal economic impact, is just not as popular. People don't like to hear about investments in bridges and sewer systems and highways and roadways, the same way that political leaders get animated about investments in sport architecture. And I think it's true that we increasingly see downtown areas and civic culture being identified by a sport building. And that's certainly true. I just wonder what that says about us as a society, that we don't look to, say, our pride in our educational systems or pride in other aspects of civic life, and we rely increasingly on public funding for private enterprises in the world of big league sports as our new mode of urban regeneration. It's certainly the case that it is linked to urban regeneration. I just wonder, you know, is this the road we want to take exclusively in our big cities?
Well, a lot of investments in downtown infrastructure and revitalization get criticized as being things that are only serving upper class people. A bunch of hipster bars and restaurants downtown make things a lot of fun in a city for creative class, upper class workers who go back to their own upper class neighborhoods at night. And they don't end up serving people in working in poor neighborhoods beyond potentially adding some more tax revenue into the city that can then be theoretically distributed to those poor neighborhoods. It strikes me that a sports stadium is arguably in a different class from that, because sports are something that interest people across socioeconomic boundaries more so than a lot of other things.
That is true, although if you look at... It's certainly more true for baseball and basketball stadiums and arenas. NFL, especially if you look at the price increase between a season ticket holder at the Georgia Dome versus Mercedes-Benz, the introduction of things like private seat licenses where you have to purchase a license, in order to have the opportunity to then buy a ticket. You're seeing the pricing up of attendance, especially at NFL games. And the reality is that the NFL, if you're operating and own an NFL stadium, you're not all that interested in the casual attendee buying the cheapest seats in the house. You're really aiming for the big ticket, big money spenders who are going to spend a lot more per hour per visit in the ground, and ideally even purchase a luxury box or luxury suite. And so the sense that while sport fandom cuts across all classes, the experience in the stadium is increasingly being classed upwards. And I would argue most working class fans are increasingly being priced out of the NFL experience. It is different, again, for other leagues and other venues.
That was my colleague Adam Ragusea speaking with Benjamin Flowers, professor of architecture at Georgia Tech, and Michael Ault, executive director for the Downtown Sacramento Partnership. Just ahead, do you know where the network Adult Swim is based? Right here in Atlanta. Literally a couple of blocks from GPB. We'll take a tour. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Atlanta-based Adult Swim is home to a number of hit TV shows like Rick and Morty and Squidbillies and The Venture Brothers. Many of us at On Second Thought are big fans. So imagine our delight to find out that Adult Swim is just 5 minutes away from where I'm sitting right now. Last month, we took a tour of their studios. We talked with many producers about not just their TV shows, but their streaming shows as well. Adult Swim now offers a full host of online, live-streamed shows. We began our tour in the Adult Swim lobby that faces William Street. As you can imagine, there are a number of knickknacks and tchotchkes. I'm taking a picture of Squidbillies with his booty hunter hat and his sawed-off shotgun.
So we are standing in the Adult Swim lobby. Producer Don Smith, what do you see here in this lobby?
Great variety.
There's a poster of Ghostface Killa over here. Are you familiar with Ghostface Killa?
I cannot say I am.
Further down, this is where all the magic happens with the streams. So Fish Center Live records out of here. So they stream out of here.
Hey, I'm Vontan Abernathy. I am going to take you guys on a tour today, and we'll just start our way to meet Matt.
It's a call-in live interactive show where they play Coin Quest as well, but it's in a big fish tank. So the fish tank fish are the star of the show. And then you've got the commentators that will just banter and take viewer calls, and we have a guest on as well.
Matt Harrigan, Vice President of Digital Content for Adult Swim. Fish Center started as we had no content, no money, but we had a fish tank. We had something that was automatically beautiful. So we put a camera on that, and then we started talking about the fish, and that became compelling to us, and that was a good start.
What happens when a fish passes over the Great Rainbow Bridge?
It's happened. And for the first time in Adult Swim history, I've said this to other people felt sadness. There were tears. There was like legitimate emotion after the passing of this fish that had become part of a pet, sort of a communal pet for the streaming community. We had a ceremony. We had a ridiculous fish funeral. And you can visit the graves outside. Let's see if I can get this right. Mom, Flump, Jeremy Legg, Dottie, Long Donovan, TX Copper, Slider, Style Toy, let's see, who else? Kevin, Ted, Roy, these are all made up.
this is the digital area, so adultswim.com. And down there is where Sally Skinner sits, and she hosts Stupid Morning Bullshit, which comes on at 11 Eastern on adultswim.com. If we want to walk down that way, her desk is over there. But yeah, it's kind of quiet. We don't get a little rowdy till after the coffee kicks in.
Hi.
Hi, Sally. Nice to meet you. Have a seat. I cleaned my office for you.
You did.
My name is Sally Skinner. I produce shows here for adultswim.com. I am the host of Stupid Morning Bullshit, as well as the producer of As Seen on Adult Swim.
Let's see here. I have everything in my office is essentially like a tchotchke from the show.
This is BB.
Tell me about BB.
BB is a doll and a supporting character on our show. BB sings a song. Come on, BB. So yeah, that's BB.
He tries
real hard. But sometimes we have him on the show with us. You know, he performs physical feats, impossible physical feats.
Okay, so do you think Adult Swim would be a different, I guess, a different network if it were in another city? How much of Adult Swim is in and of Atlanta?
A decent amount. A lot of people come in and they assume that everything is either made in-house or everything is made all the way out in California, but it's a decent mix of both. We have a few shows that are made in Atlanta, and we also have several shows that are constructed out in LA. However, I will say the streaming shows, which is what we work on, 100% Atlanta-based, and I would say the character of Atlanta actually informs it greatly because we rely on the pool of people within Atlanta to spice up our show. You know, we've had Atlanta-based chefs on. We've had Atlanta-based artists on the show, Atlanta-based musicians. It's just geography alone dictates that it would be easier to get someone around the corner. So we actually have a lot of Atlanta locals come in and showcase their talents.
So I'm asking everyone this same question. Imagine that Adult Swim doesn't exist. You're trying to pitch somebody to fund it.
Yeah.
Give me your elevator pitch why it's needed.
Oh, boy. Ooh. Adult Swim is important and should be funded because we need to give 8th grade boys everywhere something to do at 3 a.m. I mean, think of all of those 8th grade boys wandering the streets alone at night. We keep them safe in their home watching reruns of Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law.
All right, Lata, where are we walking to next?
We are going to see Mr. Nick Gibbons, actually, over here. You want to walk them over to your office? Nick is an editor, producer, writer.
Yeah, my name is Nick Gibbons, and I am the host of As Seen on Adult Swim here on our streams. Yeah, the show's basically a QVC-style show where I sell Adult Swim products every week. It's a live, one-hour improvisation insanity.
And so how do you make a show like that funny?
That's a great question, and I don't know if I can even answer that, because I literally, it's a stream of conscious for an hour. I just talk for 60 minutes, and whatever comes to my head, I just spit it out. And if it's funny, I mean, obviously I'm trying to make it entertaining, but I don't know how. I don't know why anyone would want to watch me, to be honest, but people seem to like it, so I guess I'm doing something okay.
So there is so much streaming content on the web. How does Adult Swim sort of rise above?
I think what puts us above the other stuff is just is consistency. It's every day. We never stop streaming live. It's and it's live. That's the other thing. It's not. I know there's other live streaming stuff, but we've built a fan base over the consistency of our shows, and each show has its own sort of voice, and they're different from show to show, and it's just, it's a fun sort of, it's become a network like a CBS or NBC. It's its own sort of channel that you can go to, and the shows are on at the same time every day, and so if there's a show you like, you know when it's going to come on. It's kind of like the old days of TV when you couldn't record anything. You had to be in front of your TV at a specific time to watch a show or you weren't going to see it. So, and it's always live, so it's always going to be different and exciting.
So how do you get young people who are, as the statistics are telling us, not watching network TV, mm-hmm. not watching appointment television? Yes. How do you get them to come back to their computers at the same time?
I think a lion's share, I'm assuming a lion's share of our listeners are at their job, and maybe they have it on in a small screen on their computer and they have their headphones on. So I think we get a lot of viewers because it is during the day, like a lot.
So you're basically contributing to a dip in productivity.
Exactly. Yes, I will take full responsibility for that. If anyone wants to email me or whatever, I'll take it, you know, all the blame for that. But my show's on at 8 p.m., so I get all the late workers then. not the early guys. My day-to-day is an editor for the show Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, and I have it up here right now. I'm editing an episode for season 4, which will air in the near future at some point. But yeah, I just sit here at my desk all day and put everything that they shoot in order. They don't shoot it in order. I don't know why they don't do that. It'd be so much easier. But I have to take all the pieces and put them in the right order. Tell them every year, do it in order.
Right. The alcove. The alcove. Oh, shit. Come on.
You can't air that part. You have to beep that
That's
out.
That's him. That's the man.
I told you we should have killed him all.
The law tells me that you assaulted an angel with a hammer. Is it true?
What is truth, really?
Shut up.
So there we go. That's a little clip from the 4th season. I don't know if I was sanctioned to show that, but if I get fired, I'm going to come to you guys for a job, so that's okay.
It's like all the sound equipment and stuff that you see, like,
for all the streams.
On the job.
Yeah. For the streams.
Mm-hmm. And, like, the camera equipment.
My name is Anka Vlasan, and I'm a co-host of Assembly Line Yeah!
I'm Jiang Lee. I'm the co-host of Assembly Line Yeah! An Adult Swim streaming show.
What is Assembly Line Yeah?
With, like, the Assembly Line, it's that we have a goal. Like, with a lot of the streaming shows, it's either somebody watching them do an activity or having conversations or, like, discussions with viewers and stuff. And we do all that stuff, but we also kind of have a goal. Like, I think the basis of our show is, like, people tune in because they're like, are they going to build this thing or not? Is it going to be, like, successful or not? And sometimes, most of the time, because we only have an hour to build something. So most of the time, I think we do a pretty good job of building stuff, but sometimes we definitely fail. And I think people like that. People like watching us struggle and watching us, I don't know, mess up.
How important is the gender element of it? Because almost all maker shows are guys. Even when you see those home remodeling things, the woman is doing the design and then the guy is doing the construction and destruction. So, I mean, how important is it that there's these two makers and you're both female?
So this is going to sound like we're really dumb, but it's like I like literally never think about that. Like we just do it.
Yeah.
You know, like I've always kind of been like crafty growing up. So when Jiyoung like asked me if I wanted to work on the show with her, I was like, hell yeah, because like I love making stuff all the time. And I also like, I don't know, like we make crafts since, I mean, well, we build things, you know, so everyone kind of comes to us thinking that we make crafts. Right. We're like Martha Stewart's because like we like, I don't know, we're very blunt. We're every time we're asked to like promote something, if it's like not a good build, we just like crap all over it. And like, but just like that's just how, I don't know, I think it's just like I said, like me and that's just me and Jiyoung, like we don't,
yeah. I mean, for me, like it never really even like put it like, you know, like never even thought of the gender aspect of it, just because like I'm kind of like a loner in the truest sense. I don't really have a lot of friends, you know, so when I think of identity, it's like a me, you know. Not any, you know, I don't, like, really think of it as in a group of people, so I think that's, you know, so I never really thought of that, you know, because, like, I think a lot of people tend to think of themselves in, like, tribes or everything, but I just, like, I guess, and I'm a narcissist in, like, the largest way, because for me, the world is categorized as me and the others, so I never really thought of that aspect of it, so.
So, how does the streaming service especially stay relevant when so many other places, it's not just MTV, it's VH1, it's a lot of the stuff that was aimed at younger people is not relevant anymore.
Streams is relevant because we actually, I think, interact with people. Although I would say it's not like a large amount of people. It's not in the millions, I would say. But, you know, I think it stays relevant because we actually interact with people like, you know, of all, you know, ages. You know, I think that's how it stays relevant because there is a very immediate feedback.
Yeah, and I feel like because there's like a community, like the people that stay like on our chat, they'll like just watch adults or they'll watch the streams like for 8 hours a day and just like chat with people and just like they know all the shows. They know like all this stuff about us. One of our viewers came for Jiyoung's wedding. It feels, I think people think that we're their friends, which, you know, we kind of are, because when people call in, we're like, oh, like you again, hey, how's it going? So I don't know. I think, yeah, I think like that, like it feels a little bit more authentic than like all the other like street, like, you know, if you were to like watch a show or something.
Hey, are you ready for your close-up?
Yeah, we'll get you down this way.
Silly. So if you could just put that in a comfortable place, like right, like anywhere on there.
I'm going to angle it because I popped my piece.
Hey, Celeste, can you say hi?
Hi. Hi, here's Celeste. And this is the level that I talked
about. Thank you.
That's a good level.
Okay, Doc, in 5, 4,
3, 2, 1. Stupid morning bull. It's the best show on the internet. Stupid morning bull. It's a place where you can make a new friend. Stupid morning bull. It's on right now. Well, guys, I have a very special treat on this media heavy day. We have an actual media legend in the house. Everybody, please join me in welcoming the one and only Celeste Headlee from On Second Thought, as well as various TED Talk performances. Come on up and welcome.
Thank you.
So you, my friend, have a radio show.
I do.
And it is called On Second Thought, and it is on a much smarter network than ours.
I think that's fair.
Yes, I think so too. I was listening to NPR this morning, and I don't normally.
I'd also like to say that I couldn't watch the whole Golden Globes, and here's why. Because, like, when NPR puts morning in the title of a show, they mean that you get to work at, like, 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you guys have put morning in the title of a show, and you don't go until 11.
And it's technically the morning.
Yeah, technically. Like, you're sliding in just under the one. I'm just saying I have to get up early.
Yes, that's true. That's fair. We don't at all. But it's 8 a.m.
I just wanted to point that out.
California.
That's why I couldn't see the whole.
So how late were you up, would you say?
I stayed up late, which means I went to bed at like 9:30.
Wow. Wait, so when do you have to be in the morning?
I get up at 4:30.
Do you think our show would benefit if we all got up earlier and showed up earlier?
Are you guys morning people?
Yeah, I am for sure, yeah.
Doc is. I'm not really. I mean, we could.
You have to play to your strengths, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
And then are your viewers actually morning people? Would they watch at 5 in the morning?
I mean, probably no. No.
So
no, they don't even want to watch at 11.
You're probably at 11 is good.
All right, fair enough. Well, we're glad that you were able to. This is kind of like your afternoon break. So thank you for spending it with us.
Yeah, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about what you do at NPR and why, or public radio, and why you love it. If you love it.
I do love it. Yeah, I would never go to commercial TV because I don't want to report on weather and celebrities.
Yeah, I get that.
So what we do, I try, especially with On Second Thought, I try very, very hard to cover the news in a civil, respectful, smart way. So we don't ever allow pundits on the show.
We are basically like journalism sisters.
Right, we're twins.
Yeah. We do the same thing. So when you say stories that fall through the cracks, would you mean like here's one we're going to talk about. Woman attacked by cat, then run over by own car by cat.
That would not meet our standards for a story.
Standards meaning like...
Yeah.
Right. We're trying to take the show to a next level. My whole point in having you here, I'll just be transparent.
All right.
Make us better, make us smarter, make us more streamlined so people listen to us and give us the respect we so deserve.
I know what job I want here.
If you ever want Don on the show, he is our resident curmudgeon. He can be curmudgeonly about everything.
No, I don't want to be curmudgeon.
Oh my goodness, you should come build with the...
I want to call that show.
That's our On Second Thought team taking a tour of Adult Swim headquarters right here in Atlanta. You can find a schedule of all their online streaming shows at adultswim.com/streams. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. We talked earlier this hour about sports stadiums. Do you think they provide a valuable service to cities, and are they worth the hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars that they cost to build and maintain? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can find us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headlee. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.